This is a production of Cornell University.
I call this meeting to order at 4:33. First item on the agenda is the approval of minutes from our last meeting, January 31st. Are there changes to the minutes?
Madam Chair, as we discussed at the UA Exec earlier today, I have numerous changes to the minutes, far too many that can be covered here in this meeting, and I would request to table the minutes so that we can get them updated, corrected, and a better copy out for members to approve at a later date.
Is there a second to that motion? All those in favor? All opposed? Abstentions. Motion passes unanimously.
And for those who might have minute changes, you can email your changes or edits to me, and I'll consolidate or work to consolidate anybody's comments with the ones I'm already working on and get a fresh copy out as soon as we can.
Next item is call for late additions to the agenda.
Is that already on the agenda?
Yeah.
Resolution 2.
And also introduce Resolution R7 from the Codes and Judicial Committee.
Are there any other data additions? Okay. Moving on to committee updates, starting with the Campus Infrastructure Committee.
I'll be brief. The Campus Infrastructure Committee has Resolution 2, as you can see later. We also are talking to the transportation people about some traffic enforcement ideas and also parking changes. So, but that will probably be discussed at our next meeting, going forward.
Sounds good. Next committee, Campus Welfare Committee.
So I'll just keep it brief. We had Lynette Williams come in to speak with us. She gave us an update, provided us more information on the UDC, the University Diversity Council, and she talked about the generation gap and of how many staff and employees are finding it difficult, not only helping their children, if they do have children, but their parents as well, or I guess people a generation older than them.
Mm-hmm.
And we also talked about surveys online. Students take surveys every semester regarding their input for classes. Most of those results aren't readily seen, so we're brainstorming ways in which students can have access to those.
Okay, and then the Codes and Judicial Committee. So,
big thing happening. So, at the February 10th meeting, we had Resolution 6 that we're going to talk about today. And then at the meeting last Friday, we had Resolution 7, which is the CJC's recommendation for the entire Title IX issue, both of which will be discussed. And I know one will be voted on today, the other will be voted on at the next meeting.
Moving on to new business, seeing how President Scorin is not here, we'll table that until he arrives. And we'll start with discussion on Resolution 6 submitted by the Campus Infrastructure Committee, or Codes and Judicial Committee, recommending improvements to the Code of Conduct currently. So if Ari or Phil want to...
We'll introduce it in our more detail. So these were four, four changes here. We changed to
time to come up, Bill. Ari, can you bring up R6? And if you don't have easy access on the thumbs up.
One is basically that training will be provided to the caring the appeal board, the hearing board, and the university review board to handle sexual harassment and abuse cases, assault, rape, things of that nature. The second bullet is to add for the period in Title 33E3A of the code, and to include as follows: except that in the case of sexual harassment, abuse, assault, or rape, the victim or the accused may ask for a hearing panel composed of 3 faculty members and 2 non-faculty employees drawn from that pool. So we're going to talk about the composition of the board that will make judgments on such cases. The third one is to add a new 5th sentence to Title 33E3B6C, and that would go as follows: in particular, to avoid the risk of intimidation in cases of sexual harassment, abuse, assault, or rape, the hearing board chair shall require cross-examination of the complainant or victim to be conducted by written questions submitted in advance or in real time, including follow-up questions, and read aloud to the witness by the hearing board chair if the witness so requests. So this is really talking about cross-examination and how people are questioned in such cases, because there's been situations that where things have occurred that don't have to occur.
Intimidation.
Exactly.
This would prevent a lot of that inappropriate intimidation.
Exactly. And the fourth bullet is add a new one sentence to Title 33E3B7, which goes as follows: witnesses shall not see or hear other evidence presented at the hearing, such as any police report, except as the hearing board chair determines to be appropriate, again to ensure there's not intimidation and things of that nature.
Okay.
All right. Do you have anything else to add?
I'd be happy to answer any questions about what those mean or what any specific one is trying to address.
On the very last one, I presume the witness is the accused, right? Is that what the person is, or is it? Or is it not?
It could be the accused person. It could also be a friend of the accused person, any other person. It could not necessarily be the accused person.
So, what is the point of keeping from, let's say, the accused evidence, which I would presume be against him, such as a police report? I mean,
I think I'll yield to Mary Beth Grant to answer that.
I actually interpret it as not including accused persons or complainants, because I think that you're absolutely right, Professor Howland, that those folks need to know what's being said about them so that they can adequately defend the case or adequately present the information from the complainant's perspective. But there was a situation a couple of years ago where a witness who was a friend of the accused person was handed the statement of the complainant, a statement that she believed was confidential and would not be shared outside of the the hearing board and the people who absolutely need to see it. And it gave the witness, who is not a party to the case, the opportunity to comment on whether he thought her statement was accurate or not. It was really inappropriate and a violation of her privacy. So that's what specifically addresses. The other aspect of that, too, is that when you're doing an investigation, we want to make sure we know sort of that in silos what person A and person B and person C remember. They might remember things slightly differently, but there can be cross-pollination of memories if the witness has information that another witness is presenting.
In Title 33E3A1, what happens if the victim or the accused wants a non-student hearing board, but the other one doesn't?
I'll ask Mary Beth to correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that it's not a
a choice of sexual assault or sexual harassment, it will be a non-student hearing board. And that was the recommendation of the committee, that there was a feeling that because of the way students interact with each other on campus and have classes together, that it was inappropriate to have somebody to potentially be in class with as a fellow student sitting in on this kind of a hearing.
So do we want to change the words from may opt to it will be?
Yeah, no, I
there was a choice.
But I think I interpreted it, Randy, that if there was one person wanted and one person student, then the weight would be given to the person who did not want students.
Yes.
Sorry, I think that's very well. If either of them opt, as opposed to...
Yes.
If either of them opt, then that's... Then it becomes...
But if both parties say, no, I want students on this panel, students are needed to interpret it, and I don't mind seeing them at parties later, then I think that's okay.
Should we write that if either the victim or the accused, or either the victim or the accused may opt, or something?
I think it's
the first one.
Yeah.
The victim or the accused may opt.
I think it's not clear what happens if only one does. But should that be written in there?
I think
it is. The victim or the accused may opt.
I think the other describing the victim and the accused may opt as opposed to or.
And they don't have to both agree. If either one wants this, then students will not be on the panel.
Right.
And let me add as an overlay. So everybody here knows that the CJC has been dealing with Title IX issues, these issues, for a long time. These school recommendations have been out there for quite a while, and in different proposals, the people who prosecute, for lack of a better term, the people who defend, for lack of a better term, all support these changes to the code as good things. These are not the controversial parts of Title IX, and these are not new. They've been around for a while. They've been vetted with all interested parties, and we thought rather than keep them hostage to the larger issue, this is something that everybody agrees would be an enhancement to the code, an improvement to the code, not related to preponderance of the evidence or other things where there's clear differences of opinion, and they have been well vetted, well tested. They have the support of Mary Beth Grant's office. They're acceptable to counsel's office. And the folks in the judicial codes, folks in the law school, all recommend the support. The CJC unanimously voted to support this resolution, except I think for the chair who abstains in these cases, but because he's the chair, not because of some other lack.
It was also supported and originally proposed. The exact wording actually comes from the Women's Resource Center.
Mm-hmm.
They were had a direct hand in writing the language.
Motion to close the session.
I just had a couple things I was wondering. The first thing I was wondering was for add before the period in Title 3E3A1, except that in the cases of sexual harassment, abuse, assault, or rape, the victim or the accused, would it be possible to change that to alleged victim? Because I just feel that it infers that, you know, the person who is accused is kind of determined in a way. It infers mm-hmm. that almost.
Actually a term of art in the code. I hear what you're saying, though. We don't know until something has been adjudicated.
In other words, this is consistent with the code. I think it's a good point. As a term of art, is consistently used victim and throughout the code. I agree with the sentiment, but I don't think we want to change the wording because then it begins to murky the waters on the other parts. Is something different intended here than in the rest of the code?
you're bringing up again some of the things that need to be looked at in the code overall.
Yes.
Actually, the other term that could be added there is complainant or victim.
Complainant is another term of art.
And those are often, they really are two separate things, because a complainant is somebody who's actually wanting the case to be brought forward on his or her behalf, and a victim might be somebody who has experienced some type of injury or problem, but doesn't care whether or not the university brings it forward.
But in the context of this bullet, would the complainant be able to opt out of a hearing panel? In other words, what exactly would be proposed to this bullet?
I think it should be complainant, comma, victim, or accused. Because the complainant or victim are different. They're two different design terms. Although both could be the target of some type of problem.
So, is that a motion for an amendment to the resolution? Currently? Okay, is there a second? Is there any further discussion on that amendment? Seeing none, we'll vote on the amendment to the resolution. This isn't voting on the resolution, it's just on the amendment to it. All those in favor of amending the second resolve clause to say complainant, comma, victim, or the accused, all those in favor? Say aye. Raise your placard. Raise your placard. All those opposed? Abstentions? Motion passes 9-0-1. Or 2, sorry.
Just as a confirmation, like, these things don't correct me if I'm wrong, when I was reading through them yesterday, they don't address the burden of proof issue.
No.
They're more.
This does not resolve the Title IX. It improves the code related to Title IX issues. Or sexual harassment, sexual assault, right? I mean, let's not even talk about Title IX. That was the genesis of where these came from, but it touches it, but it's not the impetus.
It actually predates, these suggestions came from the Victims Advocates and the Women's Resource Center sometime in March before spring break last year.
March, okay. Sorry, I apologize, I'm just looking through stuff.
Okay. Is there any further discussion on the resolution as a whole? Seeing none, we'll move to a vote. All those in favor of passing Resolution 6, raise your placard, please. All those opposed? Abstentions? Motion passes. It is 10-0-1.
What's your vote?
Oh, sorry, 10-0-2. Did you two abstain from the first?
No.
From the amendment?
Mm-hmm.
Did you vote for it?
Mm-hmm.
Shoot.
The first is 9.
No, the first would be 10.
10-0-2.
Had 11
votes in the first round and 12.
Right, that's what we're trying to
get. I know, I just counted wrong because there's so many. Sorry.
Who's got the hanging chad?
Okay, so the first one should have been... Okay, could everyone vote again on how they voted for the amendment?
The amendment.
Sorry, for the amendment to the resolution, not the actual resolution. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Okay, it's 11. All those opposed? Abstentions. Okay, so 11-0-2 for the amendment. Now, on the actual resolution, if you just vote again, all those in favor? All those opposed? Abstentions? It's 11-0-2 again.
All right.
Sorry about that. Moving on to the next item on the agenda is to discuss the university's engagement with the Fair Labor Association. This is related to Resolution 4, and we have Mike Powers to speak a little bit on that. Yes, come to it.
Get the president.
Yeah, that's right.
Everybody gets tomorrow off.
Ding!
Have a week's sex. Thanks for inviting me. My presence is kind of a result of the resolution was passed when it was delivered to us. I called Ari and I pointed out that there were several misrepresentations of the Fair Labor Association in this document. And wasn't sure what that really meant, but I thought it should be made known. So I have interrupt me anytime with questions because I'm trying to rush through this, and it's a little bit complicated. But let me start with the fact that we belong to two worker rights monitoring groups. One is the Fair Labor Association, the other is the Worker Rights Consortium. I should point out that I'm on the board of the latter. They differ in any number of ways. The Fair Labor Association board is comprised of representatives from universities, from brands, and from NGOs. And the, I don't know if you follow me, follow along with me here. The brands in question are these days Russell, Patagonia, Syngenta, Hanes, Adidas, and Nike. There are also six university reps: Texas, Penn State, Notre Dame, Washington University, and St. Louis, Princeton, and the University of Washington. The Worker Rights Consortium exists. The board is made up of five reps of universities, five reps of United Students Against Sweatshops, and five reps from NGOs. There's a striking difference, and what we're dealing with here is a distrust of the FLA that has existed since day one by virtue of the fact that it has corporations on its board. And there are parties who maintain that there's an inherent conflict of interest in this type of a structure. You can also, if you look at their staff sizes...
Would you actually comment on the conflict of interest? Because to me, that's the biggest difference between these two things.
Yeah, it is, by far.
So, Vic, would you comment on the conflict of interest? If you see it as a conflict of interest, if you don't, what is a conflict of interest?
Well, if you look at the six companies that are on the board, specifically Nike and Adidas, and if you look at the six universities that are on the board, all but one of these universities have what are called sideline agreements with either Nike or Adidas, meaning that they get, I know what Cornell gets from Nike, so if you think about it, knowing what that number is, they probably get over $1 million worth of free or discounted athletic equipment and apparel each year from either Nike or Adidas, depending on who they're affiliated with. So you can look at that, make of it what you will. But then there's also the question, you know, can brands be involved in an organization and objectively monitor the workplaces in which their apparel has been made? Some say yes, some say no. They do good work. There's no question that they do very good work. The way they go about their business, they will make unannounced visits to factories. There are something like 4,000 overseas apparel factories. They do a factory inspection. When they have their report together, they send it to the companies that are using that factory with the understanding that those companies then have the responsibility to go in, work with factory management to correct the problems. So if you look at Nike, for instance, the evil empire, as they're so often seen, you have to ask yourself, if they're really doing this to sort of, you know, cover up what's going on in factories, they're making it extremely difficult on themselves because they have had to go in over 160 times to factories that, in which they are sourcing apparel. So it's an awful lot of work for something that some would say is a facade, is a charade. So. Does that make sense?
Well, so let me... Oh, go ahead.
No.
So let me put this another way. In Resolution 4, obviously, it was sponsored by the Students Against Sweatshops.
Right.
They talked to us. We didn't, unfortunately, talk to you as early in the process as I think we would have liked.
Right.
President Skorton clearly did. Why should Cornell maintain its representation with FLA versus sever it as we recommended in Resolution 4? What is the counterargument that is strong enough that we should continue to associate with?
The argument would be, and I'm not espousing either stance on this, I do think it's a very legitimate organization. I do think it does a lot of good work, but we're really down to three issues with them. One is the makeup of the board, and I should also mention that the voting structure, the voting protocol is such that some of their issues require just a majority vote. Others require what they call a supermajority vote, which requires you have six reps in each of the three organizations, so you have to have a majority within each of those three groups in order to pass something, which makes it possible for all three to stonewall anything that they don't want to see go through. Now that's where you sort of have to ask yourself, are the brands protecting themselves with this type of a model? And you can argue that they are. The second big issue...
Would you argue that they are?
I don't know, because I can't say that I have followed their voting very carefully over the years. They certainly have the ability to. Now, one area where I can see them is we're going to present them with this. Another big area where we have a conflict is... when factories suddenly close, and this happens all the time, management will leave in the dead of night. They'll leave a workforce behind that's owed, you know, hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars of severance, and the workers are just left high and dry. Now, there are some schools of thought that the brands who source in these factories should be responsible for the severance. The codes of conduct that we use, the Collegiate Licensing Company, the Worker Rights Consortium, they're a little loose on that, on whether that's really the case or not. They talk like their codes require this, but if you really look at them, it's a little gray, and I think both organizations need to really, you know, look at their language and make it completely specific and you know, make this a requirement. And so, the third point we need to raise with them is the interview model for workers. The FLA interviews everybody off-site in their homes, you know, wherever, away from the factory. The WRC, that's it. The FLA will interview people in their homes, but they'll also interview them on site, which has led to intimidation and the type of thing that you would expect when your bosses know that you're talking to the bad guys. So these are the three issues that we're going to be putting before them, and our membership will probably be contingent on their reply.
And you say we Cornell, or we a larger subset of the university members?
We Cornell.
Okay.
The president's willing to do this. And so I would like, if it's at all possible, because you know, you pass this resolution, some of the facts in it are not straight. So in order to sort of, you know, make the record clear, do you change the wording and revote, or how is that handled?
Well, one of the things, if I may, Madam Chair, that our discussion is, so we set up Resolution 4, President Skorton didn't support it. I mean, he didn't sever ties. He's going to work through this process, which we were not fully aware of.
Right.
And the question for the members will be, do we, go into monitor mode and wait until new facts are in evidence and then revisit it if needed? Or do we re-engage President Skorton, who could show up any minute and start right then and there with, we think he got it wrong and he should sever ties while this is worked out, or, you know, and so really, what does the membership feel? Did President Skorton get it right, or does President Skorton need to be asked again?
Well, let me give you a little more background. We've been having discussions back and forth with the FLA, R.S. Van Heerden, who is their CEO, and some people in Washington for a good year now, putting our problems in front of them. It's been slow, as these things are. So what I would like to do is leave here with the ability to say that the Cornell University Assembly has recommended disaffiliation. So,
you have that. We have.
Okay. My question is, does this document need to be rewritten so it's accurate?
I think, yeah, I understand.
Yeah.
Because it's not. I think we can do that. I'm not sure we can do it at this meeting.
I guess what I would say is that I'll put that on the next meeting agenda and would be glad to take your, where you think it's wrong, and we can vet that, and if you think it would help give any kind of gravitas or whatever to your pending meetings, which I thought some were rather imminent, is when would this discussion would you be having with them?
I would like to do it this week. So if this is just a matter of semantics, and
well, if the changes are simple,
it's not going to change. Can I accurately say that the UA is backing disaffiliation?
Tell us
about the changes.
It's just there were representations of the FLA that were just inaccurate. Specifically, it said that it certifies as compliant corporations that Cornell later found to be violating code of conduct. They do not certify companies. They are not in the business of, the magic wand. You're good, you're good, you're not good. That's it.
Give us one other, and then we'll see.
Okay, the other is, it refers to companies they are charged to oversee. Which,
are
again,
you
they do
look
not
at our
oversee
four?
Companies.
Yeah.
Here's Tommy.
President Skorton already gave us the day off.
Just the only meeting I go to a lot of meetings where you're always eating.
We never leave. We just eat.
So the question is, if I can say that the UA is recommending disaffiliation.
These corrections sound harmless to me. I mean, it's just a matter of getting it right.
Ari is going to pull up R4. I believe he can find it. And if there's word substitution, we may be willing and be able to deal with that here. I guess we need to see a little bit more. But I sense that people are willing.
Yeah.
Yep.
So, and we got the man right here who can say, sure, and no.
We're talking about FLA.
Yeah.
FLA. And you've already given your blessing that should we all be of the mind that we should disaffiliate.
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah.
But the one thing that's been systematic that I think is really important is that Mike and Tommy Yeoman's job, a really good job, of being consistent, not in general, generally is a washout. he's been very principle-based and consistent in the way things are being done. Give a chance to talk to the organization. Be crisp and clear about criteria for changing. And if they don't change, walk away.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we did with, what, can you remind me, Russell?
We did it with Russell. We threatened it with Nike,
which they pulled back.
Which both resulted in just very quick 180-degree turnarounds on their stance on a number of issues.
So I think the documentation of it and the communication clearly of what those things were, in concert with the students who were leading the effort, I might say, I think it was very, very important.
Yeah, I suggest we go to the president. He's going to see this later, okay? So why don't we have the president talk to us now and then come right back to this? Is that cool? I just like it.
So there's a motion to table the current discussion and I would second that.
Okay, so all those in favor of tabling the current discussion, having the president speak and then coming back to this resolution, please raise your placard. all those opposed? Abstentions? Motion passes 11-0-2. So now we'll shift the focus a little bit and go to President Scorn.
So that hardcore thing was all about a motion to table.
Multitasking.
Get a paper ballot. On the
you want to go back and discuss this, President?
So if you'd like to speak, we just had a few things that we were going to talk about. The first was Blue's views on Fair Labor Association, although that's already been set it out a little bit. And then your views on the Title IX issue and what you're looking at. And then an update on the Tech Campus. I know there was an article today in the Wall Street Journal.
Sure. On the, maybe we can dispatch the Tech Campus quickly for a second and focus on whatever you guys want to talk about. But University Communications put out reading through the Wall Street Journal, one of our outlets. I guess you could call them semi-finalists or finalist list of potential architectural firms that might be developed. Although it's not like one architectural firm is going to do this whole massive multi-step process, but this is for the first building, and we'll see what happens. I think. Is it March of 13?
Right.
That the whole thing has to be over with 11 months from now. And there's two things going on in that universe of construction and so on. One is the actual planning of the project with all the things that have to go on. Choice of the people who would do it, design, vetting of the design locally, going through the New York City version of the local zoning and design boards and so on that we're used to in the community, and then actually getting the project done. And then the other one, which is being done more or less at the same time, very unusual because of the way this was done, you know, where everybody started, all the processes start at one point in time from scratch, is that there's no master plan for the campus yet. And so the master planning process is being done at the same time. In a sort of a more typical scenario, you do master planning and you use that as a general, if not blueprint, sort of a general scheme of how you might do things. So the master plan for the Ithaca campus is not a hard and fast roadmap of exactly how to do every single construction project, but lays out some general principles. This part of campus for this purpose, student pedestrian traffic flow determines this and that, and so on. And then as building projects come up, you try to think of them in the context of the master plan. For this campus, because of the rapidity in which the thing has to be done, because it's a contract for the city of New York, it's different than what we've done before. The master planning is being done at the same time as the initial progress on the first building, which is what was announced. Not the master plan, but the architects to be. Is it short? Is that their
term? Yeah.
Okay. And so that's what's happening now. What's happening, I wouldn't say behind the scenes, but what's happening simultaneously or in parallel with it is just having named Dan Huttenlocher to be the founding dean and vice provost overseeing the campus, and Kathy Dove, the vice president, who will be, I guess you could say, sort of the chief operating officer for the campus. Now they're engaged in all of the academic and administrative planning and getting ready to execute on various things that need to be done. And I'm glad to answer questions about what those might be. Otherwise, I'll lead up the whole half hour because there's so much to talk about. On the Title IX business, I'm really, really respectful of the process that you're going through. When you send me something specific, then I'm going to take it and look at it very carefully. Of course, I'm going to go to the council and look at it. I'm going to go to Title IX coordinators. I'm going to get advice from people
who do this for a living, who I respect, and then talk to Mary Beth and others, and then and then I'll get back to you. And I've heard, you know, I read The Sun every day. First thing I do is self-defense every morning. I'm traveling, I read it online, whatever. I do. In fact, it's interesting. Everybody's reading The Sun now, right? The New York Times, reporters, everybody reads this. That's how you find out what's happening in the Cornell campus. Sun all of a sudden, we're big news.
Sun coverage is getting covered.
It's amazing. as an employee, I guess you could call it, Sun, as a columnist, I'm pleased. So I don't know what to say to you today, except that I'm looking forward to seeing the thing and getting people's advice. And the thing I'm gratified and really grateful to you for is that you're dealing with it. And we'll get to the end of it. And we'll go forward with it, with whatever way we're going to do it. It's hard for me to respond since I don't have the thing in front of me. But I'm glad to answer questions, if that's okay, unless you want that or anything else.
So I'll open the floor for any questions. Ramsey?
So one of the things in campus welfare that we were talking about is that Lynette Williams came over to speak with us,
mm-hmm.
as well as Linda Howell, and both of them mentioned an incoming, or a pending problem of how many faculty and employees are encountering a situation where they're in, I guess they termed it a sandwich generation, in which they're not only taking care of their children, younger ones, but they're also taking care of their parents or siblings who can't necessarily take care of themselves. And it's one of those situations in which you don't really look for resources until you encounter that situation. And many of our faculty's relatives or family are not really located here in Ithaca. So Cornell does have a service that helps to address this, but many people don't really know about it. So I was wondering, is there any ways off the top of your head, but
there is a way, and Charlie's probably thinking, the same thing I am. Charlie Walcott, on top of everything else he's done around here for, you've been here, 18 months now? he chairs a committee, the name of which I can never fully remember, even though I charge the committee.
Family Life or something like that.
There's no one who knows since you chair the committee. All joking aside, there's a committee that includes faculty and staff, professional experts. I'm embarrassed I can't think of the name of it, but if you give me an hour, I can get you the name of it, or we can communicate by email or press. Charlie can help you. Charlie chairs it. It sets the agenda, and the point of it is to talk about the breadth of. Charlie, how can we describe it? Work-life issues, work-life balance issues,
right.
Including but not limited to daycare, elder care, all the broad range of things that you're talking about, one piece of, one aspect of which is communication of what's available, and the other kind of communication, hearing where we're having shortfalls of what needs to be done, shortcomings. And I think we've had three meetings of that, if I'm not mistaken, have another one coming up. And I don't know whether, if it's acceptable to you, since you've shared, maybe we can bring up the communications issue.
We have, and one of the notions was there would be a website devoted to exactly this problem. And I don't know where that is, but I know it's been worked on.
So we'll follow up on that. But it's a very good point you're making, and it's generalizable beyond the one set of situations you're talking about, which is, a work-life balance issue distant from Ithaca. There's a whole bunch of them, and one of the things that the group has identified, I get to go there and listen and participate, is the lack of knowledge of current programs, as well as the need to bring a lot of the, to listen more carefully to the campus, to the people on the committee. And it's a capable committee of 10-ish people, 10, 12 people, something like that. And I actually don't know, now that I'm thinking about it, Tommy, I don't know if we've ever actually devoted either a Cornell Chronicle article to that committee or had coverage by the Daily Sun. I don't remember that we have.
No, I don't think we have.
And I wonder if that alone would be helpful. Because then, it's up to you guys to decide if it's helpful, but then people would know that through Charlie and me, they could introduce issues in that general universe. And also maybe some comfort for people to know that there is such a group meeting.
So
because we haven't covered it, right?
No, but from a promotional point of view, we also have, once the committee and the folks have had a chance to really think about what kind of promotion they want, you know, we have now the paw print, which really is going to all employees, and we can sit down and talk with you, Charlie, and others about, and Mike, who's overseen the rollout of the paw print, electronic version of paw print, can help us think about how we would go about creating a sustained kind of effort to communicate about these issues in a way that will get through to the employees who really care. That's what we have the means to do that, and we can do that fairly easily once you know what you want.
And I think through when I should call Williams, Charlie, and wherever you want, I think at least we should commit, if you're comfortable with it, not put you on the spot, to making the campus aware of the committee and aware that there's some stuff going on and that there is a place to input these things. Is that okay, Charlie?
Yes.
Okay. So can I unload that on you? That would be great. So thanks for bringing that up. Very important.
No, it's just that there is like, we would like more of an outreach issue, and we're just trying to see.
It's terrific, yeah.
Randy?
I'm
how are you?
I'm good.
Good.
I got a bursitis in my left foot, so I'm limping around. Since you asked me, I'll tell
you. She knows it.
I have a brand new, wrong kind of doctor, a brand new orthotic in my left shoe. It's killing me. Can't do anything anymore. And it just makes me constantly grouchy. In other words, you can't tell the difference.
Well, this question is a lightweight one. So, I wonder what your feelings are about the change in the standard of proof, the advantages, disadvantages.
This is Title IX.
In Title IX. Because it's a hard one, I think.
Yeah, I have no lack of humility about things, knowing where my competence ends on certain things. And I will say that when I first came to Cornell, I was struck by the process-rich nature of that part of the interaction. In other words, that there's a lot of process involved. And, you know, every campus has to develop its own way of dealing with difficult situations. And how you go through the process-rich approach that Cornell has had, or have a less process-rich approach, or change it to 6.4 and not change it, I defer to people whose opinions I respect to give me advice on that. My emotion about it, Randy, is that somehow we strike the best possible balance between accused and accuser, so that a lot of these problems are not buried underground because people are afraid to come forward. For all the normal reasons you'd be afraid to come forward, because it's embarrassing, it's humiliating, it's a devastating thing to be a victim. If any of you have never been a crime victim, it's an unbelievable thing. I once was a crime victim. I'll tell you about it sometime, maybe when we're not, you know, over 1,000 people. And everything came out fine at the other end of the deal. I still get communication from that municipality where it happened when I was traveling, letting me know, you know, sort of how things are going. And I've never been on the other side of the equation. I've never been accused of something. I mean, so talking too long and answer a question. So I can tell you that the emotions, the humiliation, and so on and so forth are massive factors. And so you have professionals who devoted focused aspects of their careers to do it. And then you have the general community environment, the sort of emotional and intellectual milieu of the community. But I hope it's fair to say that everyone is as concerned as I am about the balance between the rights of the accused and the rights of the accuser, and how to reach that balance in the best possible way and make people feel safe to come forward with a complaint or a concern, and make people feel like they are in a safe environment and not going to be frivolously accused of something. Not so much frivolously accused, but frivolously found to be culpable. That's a real, real tough situation to find that balance. And the reason it's tough is that you can lay out all of the dimensions you want in writing of a policy, but something I learned a long time ago as a doc, people, every situation is different. Every situation has to be analyzed from scratch. I hope Mary Beth would agree, and others, that you can't just put a matrix over something and push a button and the right answer comes out. And so I think it's good that we're going around and around and around on this. I think it's good that we're spending a lot of time on it. I actually think it's good, as crazy as this sounds, that there's been some contentiousness and people pushing back and forth. Because at the end of the day, it affects the general climate of the campus on both sides of that. Would you buy that, Mary Beth?
Otherwise, you have Bay of Pigs.
And so I think that that's the main emotion I have, is that there's never enough conversation about it. Doesn't bother me at all that we go around and around. Doesn't bother me that the federal agency comes in and insists on something. Our duty, especially you representing sort of leadership of the whole campus, really from the shared governance way, that we come as close as possible to optimizing that balance and not splinter into groups who really are worried about defending just the rights of the accused or just the rights of the accuser. And I'm very optimistic and admiring of the fact that I think with the iterations that you and others in the CJC have gone through, I think we're getting closer and closer to doing it. Honestly, I do.
I hope your recitals
see that. Recitals will eventually be better, because either I'll be numb down there and I can't feel anything on my head, or it'll get better. And in the meantime, I'm supporting the local and regional medical community. I'm trying to find the right answer.
Yeah.
The CJC has obviously wrestled with this issue for months now. And we've gotten input from a lot of the relevant stakeholders. Mary Beth, Alan Mittman in his office, Nelson Roth, his office,
sure.
The Women's Resource Center, things of that nature. The proposal that the UA is going to vote on is really more of a menu for what we decide is going to eventually get sent to your office. Is there any other relevant stakeholders that you would like, that you're going to consult with, that we can consult with just further down in the process, just so it makes things more smooth?
No, but no, there's that I'm aware of, but I'm glad that you talked about all of them, including Women's Resource Center. I had a chance to go to one of those feminism food for thought, and get the name wrong to a lot of these things, at Becker, and heard a variety of interesting input. And I hear about this in casual, less official settings than this, if you will. Not that this is formal, but it's an official setting. And so I think you guys are doing, really, I'm not trying to butter you up, you're doing a really good job of touching stakeholders. At the end of the day, whoever you've talked to, whoever you've gotten input from, I'm going to still go back to the people I respect, who I can touch. The general counsel, Mary Beth, and a few others. And just say, I know that you had input into this, sir or ma'am, and what do you think at this point going forward? And then the other piece of it, of course, is something that's not related to the campus sensibilities or what I mentioned in response to Randy's question, and that is to be in compliance. Mm-hmm. And that's a whole another deal. Mm-hmm. And it's just one, it's a very important area, but it's one of many areas where you have to balance the absolute requirement to be in compliance mm-hmm. with the campus know you. Just think about all the things we do all day long. It's like a nightmare, right? I mean, mm-hmm. so many things put on us. We're one of the most regulated industries. And the healthcare part of universities, I think, is the most regulated industry in the country. And so that's the last thing that has to, some dispassionate reading of where we are in terms of compliance. That's the last thing that I'll do. And I'll do it quick, as soon as you guys send it. I've been following as much as I can from the outside, following seriously through the good offices, the Daily Sun, and sort of seeing. And by the way, during that process, I've been trying not to talk to a lot of other people. I've been reading what everybody else is reading. And it's, I assume the coverage is accurate, and we'll see where you come up. Is today you're going to talk about this?
We're going to introduce this today. Hold on a minute.
When's the next meeting?
March 13th, same time.
Although I would just caution, I don't know that we'll vote on it on mm-hmm. March 13th. We need to talk to some other stakeholders,
sure.
But we will introduce it today and go from there. We're getting towards the end of the process.
The deliberate nature of this is really good. The deliberate and the deliberate nature is really important, because hopefully, at the end of the process, we're going to have something that we're going to be in equilibrium with for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully, there won't be many, many times to execute that pathway. But whatever it is, we'll be using it for a while. So I think it's good you're taking your time. And if you want to talk to me more between now and then, tell me, and we'll come back.
I get you.
Are there any further questions for Ms. Gordon?
We have 3.4 minutes, don't we?
Oh. Sorry.
We have tons of
time. Any last questions then?
Yeah, I have two of them, but they don't necessarily relate to the university assembly per se. The first one has to do with, I guess, the insurance plans that employees and faculty are offered. I think one of the insurance plans. Health insurance plans entails a longer visit with the physicians, and it focuses more of a preventative aspect and a focus on exercise.
Mm-hmm.
This is a Cornell program for healthy living.
Yes, yes, that's it.
Is that the right thing?
Yeah.
I'm part of that, which is how come I got presented. It's not the fault of the benefits department. It's reliving my second childhood by being active.
So some of the concerns that people have come up to me about was some faculty members and some employees would mention of how it costs money to enroll in the gym. So they're wondering, I guess this is more of an informal question, so we can meet later, but they're wondering what possibilities would there be if there was more of an incentive for employees or faculty members to enter the gym, or if we could reduce the barriers.
Can you send me an email to david.swarton, because I'll check with Beth McKinney and others who are thinking about this kind of stuff and the benefits and Mary Opperman and find out.
But if you're in that particular one, Cornell Plan for Healthy Living gym membership is free,
right,
at wellness on campus, and right, a discount if you go to like Island.
Yeah, that's the part I was going to check with Beth. I didn't realize that it is.
Yeah.
Okay.
Is that where you guys go in the morning, early in the morning?
No, we just wander the streets.
My wife, Professor Davison, is part of a early morning running group.
We rock on.
We are rocking on. Very, very early. And by the way, there's a little certain axiom in relationships that if there's a relationship with two people and one of them goes running early, then the other one, by default, takes care of the dogs. I just thought I'd mention that. And I feel better for getting that off my head. What's the other one? Just real quick, the other one.
The other one was, I was wondering if you have any current initiatives and trying. I know there's many initiatives being, pushed through to make Ithaca a more community-centered environment, like connecting Cornell with Ithaca College as well as the rest of the Commons as well as the rest of Ithaca, but I was wondering if you had any ones that you're currently focusing on or ones that you're...
Write me again and I'll send you something, and I'll also ask Tommy and Gary Stewart, who's our head of community relations, and maybe a couple of other people who interact with various parts of the community in specific ways. We have representatives, for example, on Tompkins County Area Development and Economic Development Group. We have those who interact with the Chamber of Commerce. And there's like a lot of big web of interaction, as of course there should be in this kind of community. So be patient with me on both these, because we have four meetings next week here. But I'll get back to you. But write, not to the Office of the President, but to David Dotsford, and I'll get with you.
Okay.
Thanks for having me here, you guys.
Thank you. Okay, so now we'll untable the discussion that we were having earlier about the Fair Labor Association, go back to that, and work on edits to Resolution 4.
So where were we? So here's
yeah.
Ari, I don't have my laptop with me. It's in my office. Ari has
suggested edits, and I just typed them up in the...
Well, I think what I need to do, I'd like to go back and just make them and then send them to you, and you can distribute them. I mean, they're minor, but I just want to study it a little bit.
It sounds like this could be handled by email.
Yeah.
Is that a possibility?
I haven't seen a vote done by email, but I don't know of any rule that would prevent it if the members would support it.
Robert's rules.
Oh, all right. So do I need to make a recommendation to suspend the rules?
Or yeah, we could have a motion or a vote to suspend the rules and allow this to be voted on via email.
So moved.
Right. Is that correct, Ari? I wouldn't say that's correct before I actually think some solution.
I'm not sure.
Robert, who?
So just to let you know exactly how this is going to work.
I think I should.
He's got a laptop with wireless if you want to log on.
I'd be more comfortable just doing it where it's quiet. And I don't feel pressure because everybody has to go to dinner. So the next step in this, you know, we have been in conversation with the FLA for over a year, both in person and via email and every other thing you can think of. And we've really distilled this down to the three issues that I mentioned earlier. So there will be a communication sent to them explaining what I just said after, you know, thank you for all the time you spent with us. These are the three issues with which we really have a problem. And they'll either assure us, they'll either fix it, or they won't. And if they won't, I think we're all in agreement that we can disability.
Can I ask two quick things? Can you recount very quickly the three issues? And secondly, I believe we have some students against sweatshops here.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Is if any members outside the, you know, or anyone in the room, but those in particular, is there one missing? I think this has been done in conjunction with your organization somewhat, but for the rest of the membership, you know.
Well, we have come down to these three issues. I have done this working with Karen Lee and Molly and Casey. So if you guys consider them adequate representation, I think we're where we need to be.
And can you recount the quick
points? So again, the three things. One is the voting protocol. And we're going to ask it to be that all issues be made a simple majority, and so we can get rid of this ability to block things. The workforce interviewing, we're going to ask that all interviews be done off-site so that the workers are not vulnerable to coercion and violence, and this has been documented, this does happen. And then the third is the severance issue. This is one that I still struggle with. Alex knows I struggle with it. We've been talking about this for 2 years. But the fact remains that there are ways that they can pick factories where they have been assured, and it can be documented, there are sufficient funds set aside so that the workers can be made whole should that factory close. I'm told that there is $500 million a year worldwide that goes unpaid to workers because of factory closings like this. And it's just it's unnecessary. It's unconscionable.
And can I follow up with the question of, okay, so in your term would be the intent to send this letter from Cornell to them. What's a reasonable amount of time for them to show progress or a response?
I would.
At what point do we go, okay, you've said you're going to do this for 10 years and you haven't, so we're going to really do it and disaffiliate?
Well, they've never said they're going to do it. And to be quite honest with you, I don't think they're going to do it. But you know, we'll throw it in front of them, and they'll either sink or swim. I know that the hope among USAS students is that this will be create a domino effect of other schools leaving. Santa Clara University, about 2 or 3 weeks ago, left. I'm trying to get in touch with some people there to find out exactly how they handled it. But we mentioned the Russell and Nike cases just very quickly. A couple of years ago, Russell shut down a factory in Honduras. And, you know, the workers found themselves out in the cold. Cornell was maybe the 10th school to pull their license. And ultimately, there were over 120 who pulled their license. And they did an about-face. They have set up programs down there to help workers who lose their jobs. They set up a rehiring program. It's not working perfectly, but this did have a desired effect. And then Nike, about a year later, it was a similar situation, and there were two factories involved. And we basically said that if they did not get involved and contribute funds, that we would not renew their license. Happened to be up at the end of that calendar year, and we were the second.
Well, Brown did.
Okay, so it was Wisconsin, Brown, and Cornell, and boom, it happened. So the first time it took 120 schools, the second time it took three. Mm-hmm. So if we've established any sort of clout here, and it, you know, and it's not that much about money. I mean, the University Apparel business is
something like 5% of the United States apparel industry. But it's about PR. It's about how the public looks at them, and they don't like being embarrassed.
I have to start with, I know nothing about economics. I don't even want to make.
Really?
What,
can I write your check?
Everybody, I interview you for now that I'm married and you're taking care of the checkbook, I have to balance it. But I don't spend much. That's my trick. So, what's the chances of bringing jobs back to the United States for this kind of thing? And particularly to New York, the Empire Zone, with New York Cornell, New York Tech campus talking about bringing jobs back to the
you
New
think,
York.
You think you're not an economist? I mean, my judgment, it just all comes down to money. And if you're going to create apparel, manufacture apparel in the U.S. and abide by minimum wage or better, the price of apparel is going to rise commensurately. I mean, there are no two ways about it. In all the meetings I've gone to and all the speakers I've listened to over the years, the most succinct analysis of this entire issue came from an economist from MIT, I think it was at a meeting out in Chicago, and he said, ultimately, this comes down to consumer education. Because if you're going to treat workers fairly, regardless of what country they're in, you're going to pay more at the register. And you have to understand why you were paying more. And if you can educate people to that fact, you know, it's a wonderful, rosy world. Can we ever get there? I don't know. There's a company in, where's Altagracia?
Dominican Republic.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. It's called Altagracia. It was started by a guy named Joe Bozich, who's the president of Knights Apparel, which is the largest collegiate apparel company. They're paying their workers 3.5 times the local hourly wage of other apparel workers in that region. And it has made a huge difference in their lives. You just cannot imagine the difference it's made. The company, I think, is still being propped up by Knights Apparel. I don't think it's flying on its own. They hope the model will work. We carry it in our bookstore. About 400 universities and colleges that carry it. And that can serve as a model. And the prices are not really all that different, and it's very quality stuff. I mean, a sweatshirt over there might be $1 more than a Champion sweatshirt. A T-shirt might be 50 or 75 cents more. So it can be done.
Just to perhaps move this issue to closure, our next meeting is in 2 weeks, March 13th. It sounds like you want to send some specific language to us to look at. I know that we'll want to have student skin sweatshops look at it. I know the members will want to look at it. I think those are the bulk of the interested parties, you know, that are involved with this.
Mm-hmm.
There's, as I read it, a clear sense that we want to support you in this endeavor to give you leverage to help in the meeting. Would a vote on a resolution at the March 13th meeting meet a reasonable deadline for you? Or you know, you talked about a week. It sounds like we're going to try to do this in email. There's a chance that we don't get it quite right, or we miss somebody and we don't get it.
Yeah. After all this time, can we wait 2 weeks? Sure. You know, the world will continue to turn. So I don't have a problem with that. If you'd be more, I think if everyone would be more comfortable if we did it Robert's way.
I think we're prepared to do it faster if you've got something that you could really meaningfully hold in a week's time, but it certainly helps our processes to get the word out, allow people to review it, to think about it, so that we don't miss another Mike Powers, as we go through this process again. And it occurs to me that we can fix the whereas is pretty probably very quickly,
yeah.
But the final be it resolved, as far as severing ties, there's got to be it sounds like some caveats about, okay, if they don't respond in do we give a defined time, a reasonable time? There needs to be some language vetted there, you know, indicating when and under what circumstances we might sever ties. I mean,
right.
That'll be where the wordsmithing comes into, because
right.
It's clear we're not going to sever it until they've had a chance to do it. It's also clear we wouldn't expect them to go, okay, and put it out in a week, and so there's got to be a reasonable time period, and yet we don't want to give them an unlimited clock, or
right,
I mean, before
right.
we come back to it and press for perhaps, you know, enforcing the resolution.
Right.
So
I'm fine with it.
If you then could get to Melissa or myself your recommended changes, say this week.
I'll do it tonight.
We can do whatever we need to do very quickly, and we'll put it on the agenda for the 13th if the members are agreeable to that. I mean, it was kind of a move, maybe one to move quicker, but...
I withdraw my motion if the second move goes.
Could you give us a recommended time that all the changes should be made by? Because you're probably the best position to...
Well, you know, this will be very interesting, because these will all be issues that will have to be voted on. And they're going to be voting on whether to change their voting protocol. Now, that in itself is a very interesting proposition. You know, I would make it a very short term rather than long term. I'll find out when their next board meeting is. I think it's fair to them to allow them to have one board meeting to put this on the table. Mm-hmm. And then that's the end of it.
Well, the other thing is if they ultimately come into compliance, we would then want to reconsider our...
Yeah.
In other words, give them a carrot and a stick, if we can find the right wording.
This is a very difficult decision because, as I said, you know, this group does do a lot of good work. And so, you have to sort of ask yourself, okay, if we align with an organization on 97% of the issues, you know, are the other 3% serious enough to disaffiliate from the organization?
Or if they approve two of our three.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, this is why I would prefer to have 2 weeks, because we can probably find the right balance of wording to give flexibility as well as accountability
mm-hmm.
in the resolution.
Okay. Anybody else? Thank you all very much.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
And do
check to our office.
29th of February.
It doesn't even access.
You really want to be clean, baby?
Yeah.
Thank you, Mike.
Okay, so we'll move on to the next item on the agenda. Mary Beth Grant, if you'd like to speak a little bit about the latest disciplinary trends.
Sure, I'd be happy to. And if I could, I'd just invite my colleague Joey Tuplicky to join me at the table. So it would be a nice opportunity for Joey to also meet all of you. I think I've met most of you before.
Hi,
I'm Mary Beth Grant. I've been in the role as judicial administrator since 1999, so going on 13 years. And Jody joined me 3.5 years ago, almost 4 years ago. I stole her away from residential programs where she's worked as a residence hall director, and Jody also has her master's in higher education, which provides a really nice balance to our overly legalistic thinking and way the code works sometimes. So I appreciate the invitation to join all of you tonight. I think a long, long time ago, it used to be that on a regular basis, the judicial administrator would meet with the UA and sort of give an update about what's going on, present the annual report, things like that. And it hasn't happened in a good dozen years. I love deadlines, though, so this was great because, as you know, I was behind on my annual report for 2009 and 2010. I got it done about an hour ago, so anybody would want copies. But in all seriousness, I also brought copies of the reports that I had done from my first year here on, just one copy each, and I brought about 10 of this year's, figuring that folks can share them if they would like to sort of take it. What we generally do is we send a copy to the chairs, so the four of you will get it by electronic mail. Steve was doing it while I came in here, and to President Scorton, and then it has been just in the past couple of years that they've been electronic copies. And then we have a list of people that we send copies to, like Peggy Beach, as head of the Office of the Assemblies, Dean of Faculty, Provost, Judicial Codes Counselor, Dean of Students, Ombudsman, so Charlie will get one, Office of the Council, Vice Presidents Murphy and Opperman for head of Student and Academic Services and Human Resources, Jane Miller, who's the executive assistant to the president, chief donor at the Cornell Police, and then members of university judicial board and the codes and judicial committee. If any of you have other thoughts about how we can, you know, sort of let folks in the community know, they're also available in our office for anyone in the community who requests them. We have resisted putting them online, and it's probably just because I'm a bit of a technophobe and have had issues, but I know that that was a suggestion that some people have made, and I would welcome thoughts about that pros and cons and give that further consideration. What I thought I would do is just spend a minute or two talking about a couple of specific things that are reflected in this report, and then anybody who wants to either take one of the hard copies or wants an electronic copy, I can send it out to you. The topic about trends, it's been really clear in the past 2 or 3 years what the trends are. Number one, serious cases, including sexual assault, primarily sexual assault cases, and number two, the approach to alcohol and other drugs. And, no surprise, they're often closely related. Most of our sexual assault cases, most of our other serious cases have an alcohol component, less so with marijuana or other drugs, but often they're alcohol related.
And you talk about a trend as being upward.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. So, if you go to page 8 of the code, this is a new section that I just added this year to take a look at, using a couple of different measures, how serious cases are or how time-consuming cases are that come into our office. Since 2001, the total number of cases has been, you can bounce back to page 4 or page 6 to see the total number of cases. Since 2001, the total number of cases has been around 800 with a slip up in 06 and 07 that's attributable to digital copyright cases. So, administratively challenging those extra cases, but not necessarily more serious. Prior to 2001, the total number of cases had been sort of in the mid-500s. So everybody's really surprised in 2001. And it's like, you know, is it because of 9/11? Is it because of economic issues? Is it because of, you know, what? Oh, North Campus had just started being a central place for first-year students. So everybody was wondering, wow, why did we jump up 300 cases in 1 year, 250 cases in 1 year, and will that stay? Well, it has stayed pretty consistently. What at the time it seemed like it was mostly the less serious cases that had caused the increase in digital copyright. People who are downloading MP3s or movies or things like that in the record industry and the movie industry going after them, that definitely attributed was attributable for a lot of the increase in the fluctuation. But in the past couple of years, we've been saying, okay, we are dealing differently with copyright cases. We've been either sending letters, not doing meetings. In 2008, we cut out first-time copyright offenses because it was just disproportionate. I think that one place showed that we had 33% of all of our cases were copyright cases. Like, that's not really where we ought to be spending our resources. Our resources really ought to be spent on the more serious cases. Is somebody bleeding? Is there somebody injured type of cases? Is there a health risk? So I wanted to analyze, before I got this report out, I wanted to analyze the more serious cases. So starting at page 8, I've done that. And I went back through first looking at serious cases that involve an allegation of a physical component. So sexual assault, weapons, choking, or injury involved. There are other types of physical cases we have that I've not included. You know, a shoving match, punch that causes a black eye, those are not included in here. We're looking at the really serious ones where we might be considering immediate action, we might be considering
a separation from the university in the form of a suspension or an expulsion or a temporary suspension. The case is that everybody sort of, what, you know, whether or not one agrees about the fact, and I appreciate your point earlier, and that somebody, you know, we don't know what happened until the investigation has been completed, but that based on if someone described a fact pattern, if one knew that that fact pattern was accurate, that there'd be three but uniform consensus that that's a problem behavior, you know, acts with knives or sexual assault, things like that. So you can see that the numbers have been going up over the past couple of years, and in particular, really since around 2008, 2009, 2010, it's really been much busier with respect to those types of serious cases. I note in the last paragraph on page 8 that there have been other busy and serious types of cases that are not physical in nature, like financial aid fraud. We've got an increase in those, or other major thefts. Yes.
Are these numbers people, are they students, Cornell community, or if somebody from downtown comes and assaults somebody with a knife, but the assaulter is not in the Cornell community, is that in this number?
This would just be cases that have been referred to our office. So I'm aware of one from 2009, I believe, who was an employee who chased somebody with a knife, but most of these reflect students who've been accused by other students.
Okay.
There might be some variation on it, but most of them are students.
So I guess, what do you think explains like this rise between 2008 and 2010? Because I know you're talking about the rise. You're trying to explain the rise, I think, 2003 through 4.
I don't have a good answer. Yeah. Part of it might be, though, that, I mean, who knows? This body in 2008 made over a period of 2 years, talked about, embedded, and made some changes. And in 2008, a new code provision, the code itself was revised pretty substantially. And some of the provisions made it clear that when there's a serious act of violence or some type of either assault or a sexual assault or something, that there has to be a very serious response. So it could be that the word is out, so people don't feel like they're going to file a complaint with the JA and there's just going to be a slap on the wrist. But I don't know. I don't know if that's the reason. I don't know if more is happening. I don't know if the same amount is happening and people are just more likely to report it.
Has the student population rised substantially? I know we've let in more undergraduates. I mean,
that would be interesting to do like a percentage change between, well, I guess for next time, or someone else could do it on the side, or I could do it on the side.
Yeah. Well, and when you look at, you know, even the high here, 17 cases in 2009 compared to the total number of cases in 2009, was 871. It's still a very small number, but the impact on the work of the office is substantial. If we meet with somebody who maybe was smoking weed up on North Campus in the, behind the observatory, one of the 12 hot spots for some dudes on campus.
The highest place on campus.
So, but I mean, that meeting will take an hour. You know, there's administrative time setting up the meeting, there's, preparing the agreement or whatever, but typically a meeting like that is going to take an hour. Compared to a student who pulls a knife on another student who is, as they're walking back from College Town and exchanging words, pulls a knife, then there's a temporary suspension, there's a big investigation, there's a hearing on the merits. You know, it's a very different amount of time spent on these different types of cases. We want to make sure that we're doing a thorough investigation, and then if the case needs to go to hearing, we want to make sure that we're adequately prepared for that hearing. So that impacts both the time spent by one of the case handlers as well as the time spent by our administrative staff. I don't have an answer for you. I think, you never know, especially looking at the sexual assault increases, because that was what really struck me, 2008, 2009, 2010, that
I had looked at the statistics. Actually, it was around the time Randy and I first became appointed when there were some questions about how were cases resolved in the campus disciplinary system of sexual assault back in around 2003. And I did, I looked at all of our statistics since they were on the computer from 1990 through around 2003 and found that on average 3 sexual assaults were reported per year. And I also found that during that time period, only one had been found in violation, 1999, and that student had not been suspended. I didn't realize I had been the only one who had had a student that went before the hearing board was found in violation. Another one had been taken to a hearing board in the mid-90s and was not found in violation. And other than that, cases were either resolved, students just left without, you know, without having any substantial sanctions, or they just stayed here. So for a very long period of time, there was really no accountability for sexual assault. Whether or not it was happening is a different question. I mean, we know that sexual assaults happen. Whether the cases that were reported to the office could have been proved, they weren't being proved. And so I would think that complainants wouldn't want to come forward. From the time all of these years, 2002 through 2006, those years, those numbers of sexual assault cases, none of them went to a hearing. 2007, 2008, there were a couple of cases that were resolved by agreements. One of them went to a hearing, one was off campus before we had off campus jurisdiction, so it was resolved through Susan Murphy's office, and those students were both expelled. And then in 2009, if you read through the hearing board decisions later, 2009 was a year that 2 cases went to a hearing. There were strong facts. The hearing board found the students in violation. The review board upheld them and were able to give some guidance about what are we looking for? How do we interpret the very complicated policies around sexual assault? It's the complicated relationships. I mean, I think one of the things that President Skorton was saying earlier is that all of these policies are pretty amorphous until you start putting names and faces to them, and it makes it challenging. And when you add alcohol and you add a lot of other components of what's expected in college life, it's very complicated and very confusing. Yeah.
Sorry to bother you guys.
No, that's okay. You're not bothering me at all.
Just for like, so you think it's when you're looking at these cases, did you notice like any trend at least within the past 3 years of what I guess not. I don't want to say encourage them, but what were the other factors? You mentioned alcohol is one of like a huge factor in terms of, you know, there's a correlation between the two. But from their, I don't know how to phrase it. Is there anything underlying, or is there anything that you noticed, like I guess a relationship or some kind of tendency between these reported cases, in which, you know, it's good that they're, I guess, these are being reported and that these are being addressed. But, I mean, I'm thinking, what are ways in which we can, not, like, if possible, ensure that this doesn't happen again, or ways in which
right.
we can have a more proactive approach?
Right, right. You actually made me think of 2 different things. One is that I want to make it clear that just because a case was reported does not mean that the person was found in violation. So while I think that there's been more accountability in the past couple of years, there's also been a lot of students who have said there's not sufficient evidence and it doesn't make it to the board because, you know, in our determination, in our investigation, saying there's not enough evidence. The person may have been traumatized and it may have felt like a sexual assault from the victim's perspective, but it doesn't mean that there was sexual assault from the definitions of the code.
So it involves both. Okay.
Yeah, so that involves both. Your question about how do we get the word out, I mean, prevention is always best, and we have been trying to do an educational campaign. It's challenging, you know, trying to balance all of the different things, the planning, the education, the handling the cases, the reporting on the cases afterwards. It's challenging. So I do put in here on page 2, page 2, the last paragraph, the last bullet point, lists out the different strategies that we used in 2010 through 11 to try to educate the community about the standards of conduct with respect to sexual assault. The typo is there's an extra bullet point in there that doesn't need to be there. And that came after one of the first cases that went to a hearing in 2009. The review board, it was clear to the review board that the accused person really didn't believe that he had violated the code. It was also very clear that he had violated the code. And they said that disconnect demonstrates that there's a lack of understanding on his part, and if there's a lack of understanding on his part, there's probably a lack of understanding on many people's part about what the standards are of sexual assault under the code. So we've undertaken that, and that's continued. You know, this report ends as of July 1, 2011, but preview for next year's report, we've continued those efforts. And we have ideas for more than we have time for also.
So you said that there were countless more of these that there wasn't evidence for.
No, I'm saying among these, not all of these folks were found in violation. Some of these were also. There were probably more assaults that weren't reported. It's a very underreported crime. And I remember hearing, well, what's the statistic that they use in the Dear Colleague letter? I think it's 25% of women and 8% or 6% of men are sexually assaulted in college, something like that. I don't have it exactly right. So that doesn't reflect that percentage of our population.
Do you, I'm going to ask you to play with the ball for a second.
Yes, sure.
Do you see that, and you've seen the Dear Colleague letter, you know what the limits we're going to be discussing at the next meeting. Do you see this number rising, considering the standard evidence is being lowered?
I don't think it will increase because the standard of evidence is lowering. I think it will increase because there are more efforts to let people know about what their rights are, what their abilities are, and because the process that's being contemplated by 6.4 will be a less intimidating process to go through. One of the women who was talking for the victims' rights advocates group described a conversation she had had with a complainant, and the complainant had said, I had to testify in front of a group of strangers, and it happened that the entire panel of hearing board were all males. Some students, somebody she recognized from her college, but although she didn't know him well, somebody she recognized, and that was a really intimidating process. Versus having a conversation with somebody like me or Jody or Alan Mittman where tough questions are asked, absolutely. We have to push back. We have to figure out what happened. But it's a less intimidating process than having to talk about very intimate things in front of the strangers.
When you're first talking to a complainant, is your process going to change at all with the different standard of evidence in terms of, you know, if you were given the exact same situation 6 months ago before this is passed and 6 months from now when it is passed, are your actions going to be in terms of, are they going to change?
No, not at all, because we still have to figure out what happened. And something that I shared with the judicial codes counselors is that even since the standard of evidence was changed last April, there have still been cases where we've said there is insufficient evidence to support the finding of a sexual assault. It could be that there are competing witnesses and we can't judge the credibility of one over the other. It could be that the allegations don't even support, even if you completely believe what the complainant says, what happens is not a sexual assault. It's a bad experience, but it's not necessarily a sexual assault, even if that person feels sexually assaulted. So, but to answer your question really specifically, our investigation standards remain very high. The only thing is that at the end of the investigation, when we sort of process, okay, is this enough evidence to support the complaint or not, we will judge that a little bit differently. But most cases are either clear or they're not, and that's actually one of the ironies about the preponderance of the evidence debate, is that I think the tendency on really serious cases is you really want to be sure. You don't want to find somebody in violation of something serious unless you're really sure. And I don't know that that is actually going to make all that much difference. I think the change in the process is what's going to make the difference. Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah.
you remember the forums that we had for the campus code?
Yes, vividly.
Do you think it'd be worthwhile? We haven't talked about this, but worthwhile for us to have a forum about this Title IX issue, and while it's being discussed, in order to educate people, what's going on with sexual crimes?
I have mixed feelings about it. On the one hand, I like the idea of trying to educate as many people as possible, and I've been really happy that the Sun has been covering the changes in the discussion so well. I think the challenge is when we know there are matters of compliance for which there is no choice, there need to be changes because of the issues of compliance, I think it can create a false sense of, hey, you can have some impact on this. And so what if, 10,000 students come out and say, we want clear and convincing evidence standards, and we don't want appeal rights, and we all are sitting there saying, you don't have a choice about that. I think it creates a perception that we're, it's almost like a false perception that we're listening, we want to hear your opinion, even though we know that those opinions are limited. So I don't know, I think there's a balance to be struck there.
Can I answer a yes or no question?
Yeah, I'm not going to.
Does the Department of Education have any business with this?
Had any business with what, the Dear Colleague letter? The Department of Education wrote the Dear Colleague letter.
In your opinion?
Were they overreaching?
Yeah. In your opinion. It's just a yes or no.
So, Randy, do you understand the reason that they are requiring the change?
Oh, yes. I understand the reason. I understand the legislative aspect of our government, the legislative branch versus the regulatory branch.
Yeah.
And that's why
That's a different question. So
that's actually the question.
But
do they have any business?
I actually think that what's important to look at is not so much whether or not we have to follow the Dear Colleague letter, but whether or not we should follow the Dear Colleague letter because we agree about the principle. Because, there are things in it that people can agree with or disagree with, like having parents bring cases on behalf of students. That doesn't make much sense at the college level. It might make more sense at the high school level or the junior high level. But the particular issue with respect to preponderance of the evidence, I had been told this before, back when we were debating the code in 06 to 08. I remember somebody said, you're not allowed to have a clear and convincing, and I raised it, but I didn't understand the issue. I now understand the issue, and here it is. When you're talking about two people who each present a different perspective about a single incident, and a body who is trying to decide what really happened. If we have the clear and convincing standard, we have those people set in different places. You're automatically set up that you're required to believe the accused person more than the person who's making the accusation. That's by definition the way it's set up in the clear and convincing standard. And it, in the preponderance of the evidence standard, you're putting them on the same playing field. You're saying that there's no other witnesses, we've got two people who are the only witnesses to an event, and you're not saying that you're going to require one person to be more credible than the other. They're on the same level playing field when establishing the credibility. So that's what it's doing, it's equalizing the ways that people are evaluating the credibility of the witness.
Well, all you have to ask is the other thing is, and you know what an advocate I've been for the victims' rights on this, but you have to ask, is it worse to make a mistake for an innocent person than to make it harder for somebody to bring a charge? And that's a hard question.
They're all hard questions, and it's why I have to go to the hairdresser every couple of weeks. A lot of gray hair over this. It's hard. It's absolutely hard.
I know we need to move on to the rest of the agenda, but very briefly, one, do you and the Cornell Police and the Ombudsman get together periodically or once a year and discuss your trends and perhaps preventative measures?
We do with the police. We never have with the Ombudsman's office.
My thought being, we're adjusting the Cornell calendar or looking at that to perhaps relieve stress, and we hope that that will affect suicidal trends. somewhat, you know, relieving that a little bit. As you've said tonight, and I can believe it, alcohol, especially in the more serious things, is almost universally involved. And I know that President Skorton had, earlier this year, started a lot of initiatives trying to deglamorize alcohol or you know, and those things. You would hope that if those efforts are successful, that your trends will become less, or at least in the alcohol-related component that led to perhaps pulling out a knife, losing that much more judgment.
Right.
But I don't know if you three get together at any point and actually look at a systematic approach and then benchmark and see, well, it's working or not working, or, you know, it's lost focus.
Yeah, one of the challenges, and Jody actually is really good at gathering statistics and analyzing trends and stuff, and one of the challenges is we really haven't had much time for it, but it's also a challenge because some of the work that we're doing, we're planting the seeds now that aren't really going to germinate until the students are 30, and they'll remember, oh, I remember when I got in trouble, or, you know, so it's a little bit hard to measure. But, you know, we're always open for those kinds of discussions. I'll just say one more thing with respect to alcohol stuff, because I think that this is an important component of our work in the last couple of years. There were some studies done at Gannett looking at students who got in trouble frequently, even for low-level alcohol violations. So by frequently, I mean three violations in an 18-month period. And they examined what actually was the situation with those students over a two-year period. They looked at all the folks who got in trouble for alcohol in three times in an 18-month period. I don't remember the percentage, but it was high 80s or low 90s of those students, the particular students at Cornell, were alcohol dependent, met the qualification for alcohol dependent. And the reason they looked at that information was that they were finding that their level three of alcohol and drug intervention wasn't really working, that it seemed like the students were not being particularly successful at school, they were not being particularly successful giving up alcohol or seeing that it was a problem. And what they identified is that these students really needed to go somewhere and get treatment somewhere else. So based on that information, we adjusted some of our approaches to repeat low-level misconduct, particularly when alcohol is involved. And the hearing boards have really supported it. I think they were surprised that we weren't in the past seeking suspensions earlier, that it would take, for low-level conduct, it would take, you know, 5, 6, 7 cases before we would say, really, you need a break, you're not following the rules, you're not, the progressive discipline isn't working for you. And now for cases much more quickly, we will seek suspension. And people were worried that it was going to happen all the time, you know, over the course of 3 years, it's happened 6 times, a couple through hearing boards, a couple through agreement. But the overall impact has been very positive. Individual students have shared with me, you know, now coming back after their suspensions, saying that it was a good thing for them. They really needed treatment. They didn't realize that they were in trouble. They didn't realize. One student, during his cross-examination and hearing, said, I didn't realize I had an alcohol problem until I was being faced with suspension. And another student, that after he came back, said, I really didn't want to be here. You know, he had some legacy thing, so it was a benefit for him to be here from his parents' perspective, but he didn't want to be here, and he wasn't doing anything except smoking dope all the time. So it was a waste of everybody's time and money, and he's coming back now much more energized, much more excited. So sometimes what seems like, ooh, it's a harsh kind of thing on the one hand, on the other hand, it's really from both a developmental, behavioral and medical perspective, it's a much better thing for the community. Oh, and the other thing is that Gannett said that their counseling is more effective now because students realize that there is an end, there is some type of consequence at the end, and then it has been more effective. So those were the main trends I wanted to talk about, and I'm happy to hang around later if anybody has any questions. I know Charlie needs to talk also. Yeah. I'm sorry, I don't
want to... No. So on that note, we'll turn to Charlie Walcott on the latest trends he's been seeing.
I'll be very quick. First off,
Let me explain what the ombudsman is, because I have discovered that many people around this community don't have a clue. And basically what we are is a place where you can come and talk about issues that are bothersome of one's flavor or another in confidence to somebody who has a lot of experience around the university. There are three of us in the office. There's Linda, who used to work for Mary Beth, who is well familiar with the undergraduate scene and with the codes and judicial and that whole side of it. I, for my sins, have been around a number of years on the faculty and have a certain idea about how faculty might or might not work. And Adam is a new recruit to the office, but is an expert in mediation and actually attended the Barnum and Bailey Clowns College. So he has many, many capabilities. We have a series of tenets that we ascribe. First off, we're independent. We're not part of the public human resources or the president's office or anything like that. We are responsible, in fact, to the community, which is you folks. So you are all my bosses, is the way I look at it. We are neutral, that is, we don't take positions. We are also confidential. We don't reveal any details of the people that come and see us, so I can't share exciting stories about what wonderful things we've done for our customers, because I can't reveal who they are or what happened. With some exceptions, the two exceptions are if we're required by a court of law or if we are believe that somebody is in imminent danger to themselves or to other people, then we would have to do something about it. And we're informal. We're not part of any formal process. We see about 300 people a year is about our caseload these days, give or take an Oz. And of those, I would say that the majority is staff, about 82 staff cases. There were some academics, about 58. There are undergraduate students, about 76. There are alumni and parents who we see from time to time. There were 22 of those. And we had 30 grad students cases. Typically, the kind of thing we see is a staff member who is having trouble in the workplace for one reason or another. And it may be that they feel unhappy about some coworker or their boss, and they want to come to us for counsel and advice. What would you do? And so we take the time to go through the options and talk through the pros and cons of each one of these things. And I think by and large, we are effective in heading off a lot of situations which might get more complicated had they not had somebody to talk to. I think the major issue that we face, and this is where I would like your help and advice, is that people really don't understand what we do. People, I meet my faculty colleagues and they say, oh, you're the ombudsman. What's that? So I go through the litany that I just went through with you to try and explain what it is. And I think we need to do a better job of publicizing what it is. And one thing I thought we would do is send out a bunch of cards once a year to faculty and staff, which simply explain what we are in simple terms and invite them to make use of our services. But I think this how to reach the student body is much more complicated. You say, well, what kind of issues do you ever get from students? Well, it's issues with roommates, it's issues with student housing, it's issues with faculty members of one sort or another. It's almost anything you can imagine. And we try very hard to be helpful and supportive and aim them in the right direction. So that's my message, and I'm happy to...
Regarding getting the education piece, if you haven't, I would recommend that you make connections with the onboarding center, because they're going to start bringing non-students, but everybody is going to go through one consolidated process before being turned over to their work unit, and get the boiler, you know, all the policy piece, the diversity piece, all the, you know, the things that everybody needs to know to be in good standing, stay in good standing, it might be an opportunity to let them know right up front, you know, and if problems develop and you're not sure where to turn, here's who we are and here's what we do. And it could be part of bringing people on board, and they would have heard from you from the start.
Thank you. That's a good idea.
Yes, also for education for undergraduates.
Yes.
I know in the beginning students go through Tapestry and they also get like a packet of information. And I remember most, I had a couple roommate issues, not necessarily with me, but I lived in a triplet, triple. And the common avenue was going to your RA first.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a procedure they kind of listed out on that sheet. So if, I don't know who's responsible for sending out that quarter card or that piece of paper, but if you included an alternative, I guess, approach to go to your office, that'd be good. And then the other thing was we've had lots of outreach problems in the past with Tapestry and with bias response.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the common things that I've been suggesting to Lynette, as well as Linda, but we haven't officially tried it out yet, was going with magnets. And the reason why I say magnets is that when you're presenting to a group of students in a room, if you give them a piece of paper, they're probably going to throw it away. They're probably going to make it into a paper airplane.
Ours would be too small for paper airplane.
But the thing with
magnets,
yeah.
But if you make a beer bottle opener.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, scratch that for a minute.
Sorry.
I'm really sorry if this decision is taking part so late in the day, and maybe we should try and raise it again. But, Charlie, if you read the charter, which was made in a long time ago, I read it as a much more interventionist document. The ombudsman is given power to get information from wherever he or she wants, explicitly. And he or she is asked to report, and the implication is that when the ombudsman finds something structurally wrong with the university, he or she will report that, and something may come of that. So, you presented sort of a counseling picture, and I think that certainly was Waller Lynn's attitude. But I think over the years that has changed, and I think it's possible that there really are structural problems in the university which need to be brought to the attention, and that you're, and particularly among that part of the professorial or people who are in professorial-like jobs who do not have tenure, I think there may be well structural problems there. I had a friend who had worked here for 15 years in a really highly important position in the college, and he was summarily dismissed for, as far as I can tell, the wrong reasons, plain and simple. And things like that may happen more often than we think. So I hope that perhaps when we get your report, and I realize this report is mostly Waller Lynn's stuff, but I hope when we get a new report, they will have information of a sort that could help us understand what, if there are structural problems in the university, and what might be done about it.
That's a very good point, and I did not mention that, but I have had meetings with deans and with others to report back, because we learn in the course of events where there seem to be difficulties of one sort or another. And we promise confidentiality so that when I go to a dean, I don't say, we have had the following list of people from Department X who have come and complained bitterly to us. But I do try and convey that information. And as to your more general point, I think that's true. I'm not sure to what extent we see those kinds of issues. We certainly see some where individual faculty, in your case, or a staff come and complain of an issue. And we don't intervene. That's not what we do. But we certainly do provide, as they say, upward feedback.
Well, I guess I'm asking for that to appear in reports so it gets out to the public, so that you may find people who are interested in changing the situation.
So if you know 80% of your faculty cases dealt with tenure, I guess we would hope that you would leave some form or talk to President Scorton about, you know, there's a hidden trend within the trend that appears to be, you know, above the noise floor, or, you know, and perhaps find ways to look into it.
The question is yes.
Okay. But not only does the president, the
and
Charlie,
to appropriate.
Specifically says that Charlie says his boss is us. I mean, the community that he's reporting to.
Mm-hmm.
And the community should be informed.
That's right. And I will listen very carefully to what you folks say, because I think we exist for the benefit of the community, not for the benefit of any one part of the university. Randy?
I like that you had the values, ethics, and standards category.
And what was your thinking when you creating that? Well, because you find that there are issues that come to you where you feel that people have not been treated ethically. And, you know, we don't... One of the problems if you're an ombudsman is you hear one side of the story, right? As you all well know, there are at least two or three or four sides to every story. And so it becomes hard to make a judgment. On the other hand, when you hear something that seems unethical or bad, a couple of things can happen. One is I can talk to the person that's come and say there are various things that could be done. One thing is you could authorize me to break confidentiality and have a conversation with the dean of that college. And I've done a couple of those, and it's had a good effect. But each case is different, and we try very hard to protect that confidentiality side of things. Because I think if we don't have that, we don't have anything.
And I don't want to open up a can of worms,
but
the confidentiality thing, is there any changes being...
Yes, there was a major change, which was the legal status. And this came about because of Title IX and all of that. And what we finally resolved is that we said that it's confidential unless ordered by a court of law. And if it is ordered by a court of law, we have a pretty good chance of it remaining confidential because of privilege and because of what is explicitly said in our things that conversations are confidential. It's a contract between you as a visitor and us as an ombudsman. But we don't have in New York State, according to University Council, the right of privilege. I suggested that we all become ministers over there. That would give us the right of privilege. It seems easier to be a minister than be a doctor, you know. There's, in the back of the comic books, there's a form you can fill out.
I love that.
But University Council was not enthused about that.
But still, you have privilege unless it's court ordered. Okay.
We don't have privilege in New York State. Is the answer to your question?
And then who could ask you for the information?
A court of law has to be a subpoena of some sort. Yes.
Alex Forrest, Ms. Media. It seems like for an office of three people, you handle quite a few cases per year. And I was just wondering, with getting the word out, especially the students that can really take off, do you know an estimate of how many you think you could handle? Is there a point at which we need to put more resources into the office?
I think what we want to do is make it known and see what the demand is, and then we will organize to meet it. At the moment, there's one full-time person and two half-time people. I'm a half-time person, and Adam's a half-time person. Linda's full-time. So it's, you know, two full-time people. And if we got a great deal more business,
we'd have to rethink that. But I'm perfectly prepared to argue that point when we get to it.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. So at this point, it's about a little past 6:30, and in order to get to the next two things that were late agenda items, we'd have to have a motion to extend the meeting. I know a week or so ago there was notification that that might be necessary considering how busy this meeting was going to be. So is there a motion to extend the meeting to get to the next two points, basically? Okay. All those in favor of Ramsey did. And Sean motion. In order to get to the next few items, that related to the items, we have to have a motion to extend the meeting, and that's a pass, because we're past 6:30. However, a week or so ago, there was notification that that would happen.
And I would add that I think we can probably dispatch both of these in under 10 minutes.
So I
don't think they're on the agenda. That's what I'm wondering.
This was the new business at the beginning. Late additions to the agenda. Revised resolution R2 and introduction of resolution R7.
First, I don't think we have quorum.
Yeah, I suppose it's counting.
Second of all, I mean, these next two issues, one of which I'm assuming is the CJC issue, that's don't move that in 10 minutes. Like, that could take the entire time. So I would say wait for that one.
To get through resolution two. It'd be important. And I would like to pull some in the hallway.
I don't know if
we're having a conversation. Isn't that true?
Hold on.
No, and I. No, and we're not going to cover resolution 7. We're going to introduce it.
So that can be discussed fully at the next meeting.
Bridget's still here. That gives us 9 people, I believe, 9 voting members out of 17. I believe that's more than half.
Yeah.
You have good math tonight.
Excuse me. No one's would she consider herself
pregnant? Sorry.
Nothing was said. Nothing was said.
Just wanted to make sure you were here. So, the Viking launching the resolution today.
Yeah, except for we have to actually run kick from the meeting.
We need your placard. We need an extra 10 minutes.
Sorry. All those in favor, please raise your placard. Are you voting in favor to extend the meeting? All those opposed? Abstentions? Motion passes by 7-0-2. So quickly, resolution 2.
So we sent resolution 2 to pass this. This bypassed this last semester. On Q1, the Vice President of Facilities had a look at it. He liked it, but he made some changes. He recommended some changes be made to it to allow it to be added to the building policy for the university. These are just things to make it easy, the wording of it to fit easily with the.
It's on the memory stick if you need it, Ari.
Yeah. One major change is the change the project cost from $5 million to tying it to the Capital Funding Priorities Committee budget threshold, which is currently at $5 million. But it's a new policy that members can change in the future, and so the policy wouldn't have to change every time the number changed elsewhere in the building policy. We added the same language to the third, be resolved, for the results for the Becker Extension Station. Yeah, that would be added in there to make it clear.
Do you have the red line version on? It's on the memory stick.
It's named Resolution 2 with markups.
Does anyone need a copy of it that doesn't have it? You're right. Okay. Yeah, you're right.
That's the old version.
Okay, well, everyone has it in front of them. So, is there any discussion on the changes that are made? Any questions?
So, can I ask you, Sean? The Campus Infrastructure Committee looked at this. They found that the wording was not a change of intent. It was just conforming the wording with the policy. And the Campus Infrastructure Committee passed this revised resolution and recommends that we do the same. And Q Wang has already coordinated and said, if you send me this, I can put it in the policy. And we're all happy.
Yes, that's true.
What is the capital funding priority committee's budget threshold?
It's currently, I believe, 5.9.
5.9?
So the change is just allowed to go up with instead of being rewritten.
Got it. Okay.
And then what does red code for and what does green code for?
Actually, I don't think they're that much different. I think it was just different edits.
Different edits. Those are ads.
Yeah.
Oh, those are ads, and then strike-throughs are, okay.
Yeah.
Strike-throughs are
actual deletions.
But the actual green to red.
So it looks like there's a lot of words there. There it is. The reality is, despite seeing all the red that you may be able to see on that screen, it's not a change in...
It's basically wording changes so that you can put it in policy.
Single stall is single occupant restrooms instead of single stall restrooms. Converted to, identified as, it's a conforming issue.
So is there...
There just seemed to be one change that matters, which is it went from that current single stall restrooms changed to, I'm looking at the second from the bottom, DFS resolve, changed to at least one current single stall restroom, which I don't know if that matters or not, but it looks like it's going from all of the restrooms to just one in each building.
Which was
talking about be it further resolved.
I think the original language was that one current single stall.
The purpose of the resolution, I think, initially was to have one single stall restroom be identified as unisex. I think that was the initial purpose of the resolution. So that would just correspond with that.
The word at least one was added recently. So that's actually changed from this just to allow for more than one. Just like
I thought it infers exactly.
You're going to add some restrooms from the rates.
Yeah.
If I'm reading it correctly, that current single stall restrooms on the Ithaca campus be identified as unisex. Or be converted to unisex restrooms.
Yeah.
But we wouldn't want...
I don't know, but it just seems like if you have a 10-story building, that's a big difference between having one available and having, say, one on each floor.
I think the original language wasn't clear as to how many. I think this, at least one, it means the same thing.
Is there a way that, like, you know how you deleted 5 million and you listed the threshold. Is there a way to generalize that so, like, you can take into consideration what Alex was mentioning? Because that was actually I interpreted like as if you know you have one and then you're good to go in a way, which may or may not necessarily be the case. In my opinion, I wouldn't want that to be the case because you know if you have a large building, you know that's the exact scenario that I was thinking of. It wouldn't really be.
I think the issue comes down to how many do you think they have to have for each. If you want to spell out how many single occupant bathrooms you want them to have for each $1 million spent, then that's something that's not, I don't feel like Yeah, exactly. What we're asking for is that this be taken into consideration, and that when they build large, when the project goes over a certain threshold, that at least one be included, and we're not limiting it to just one.
Could we, would it be possible, so who deleted the S, I guess? That's the...
That came from Huang's office, but I don't think that that, the original, when it's originally written, that... I think it was originally written with be the further result that current single stall restrooms were.
I'm just thinking out loud. I think it would be better. Well, I'd prefer if it would be a further result that current single occupant restrooms, or you can include at least one current single stall occupant restrooms in each building on Ithaca campus to be converted to. It's the main thing that that's, I think, is holding up Alex, but at least me, is the S.
Well, that's the only reason they added a huge building, right?
The only reason
that
clause is necessary
is because it would change to at least one. And if you read that, if it said at least one, it didn't say each building, that would be one on campus.
Oh, I see.
The reason they need a building is added, I think, is because at least one is added. So it seems like that's just changing the test.
The in each building was added first. What we went through at the CIC is we took that one current single occupant restroom.
Oh, so
building.
Was it originally one?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Then we added
one.
Okay.
Yeah. The order of changes went from in each building and then went to from one to at least one.
Okay. Got it. Okay. Right. Sure.
Okay. Is there any further discussion on this resolution? Yeah. All those in favor, see those placards. Okay, all those opposed? Abstentions? Motion passes 7-0-2.
Last item?
Yeah, so Resolution 7, we're just going to introduce this so that for the next meeting we can have full discussion on it. So if Phil and
Phil, if you'll defer to me just for a second, we discussed this at the University, or the University Assembly Executive Committee. We wanted to get this out to you as soon as possible. So obviously it's late. We knew it would be late. We don't want to engage in a lot of discussion. What it's important for you to know now is the CJC on Friday, as Phil mentioned, voted on a resolution that would resolve the Title IX code issue. The net effect of this resolution, as it's written, would essentially move sexual harassment, sexual assault into Cornell Policy 6.4, which would need to be written to address it. There are some precepts that we would want considered, or would want that the CJC recommends be taken into account in that rewrite, some things that we think that rewrite should preserve in that process. There's some nuance to this, the way this is worded, because fundamentally the CJC was split over, saying that the we like the code the way it is, and we really don't want to adjust to this poorly written Dear Colleagues letter because we like our process. The flip side is it's not compliant, and we looked at ways that maybe we could find a way to split grievance procedures and from disciplinary procedures. We weren't successful at that. So we've kind of gone full circle, and I won't recount the whole ugly business. Some of that will definitely be what we take up next meeting. But you need to read this because the net effect is essentially putting it into 6.4, but it makes it clear in this resolution that we frankly prefer that we didn't have to do that. Okay? And so there's some political boilerplate in there before the net effect. When you read it, you'll understand. If you haven't read it, you'll understand that the first resolved is we should make no further changes in the code other than those already described in Appendix A. Appendix A is Resolution R.6.
It's two different options.
And should that not be found to be compliant, then put it in Policy 6.4. We already are 99.9% sure that they're not going to find that compliant because the view is that's not compliant with the law or the interpretation of the law. And you heard President Scorton say that compliance matters. But that would be the first thing, you know, leave it alone. We like our code. But if that's not compliant, put it in 6.4. So as a reality, you need to be prepared if you support this resolution or some version of it, that's where the recommendation essentially is to put it into 6.4. There's going to be debate next time. We are already beginning the process of talking to the student assembly, the graduate and professional student assembly, about getting their formal inputs on what they think about the larger and concept as well as some of the specifics. We will invite Alan Mittman, who effectively owns Policy 6.4, implements Policy 6.4 for the university, to our next meeting. The Judicial Codes Administrator, Mary Beth Grant, the Judicial Codes Counselors, folks, we hope to have there, Nelson Roth's office there. All of them having had a chance to read this and come with, prepared to discuss this resolution that you now have. You need to read it and think about what your questions are. In theory, we could vote on this resolution or modify and vote on this resolution next meeting. I frankly suspect, this is now me just putting in a crystal ball, that it's going to be the meeting after that before we would take a real meaningful vote, because I think you're going to want to hear things, you're going to want to learn a bit of what the CJC has ground through, you're going to wrestle with it, there's some other people you may want to consult, you certainly may want to walk away from the meeting and think some more about it before you vote, and frankly, I don't know that the Student Assembly has a meeting next week, I don't know when the next GPSA is, but we want to make sure that they've had a chance to talk to just more than the officers, et cetera, before we move forward, and that may not easily be done effectively before the 13th. I yield my time to, let me yield it to Phil first.
Real quickly, I know you're going, I don't know who's going to those assemblies, but I definitely think as the chair of the CJC and the person who's in the middle of this whole thing, I think it would be appropriate if I go with that person. I don't know if it's you or...
For the student assembly, Melissa.
For the student assembly, for the GPSA, for any of the relevant assemblies, I think there needs to be some. I mean, I think if it's just Melissa, for her to have to interpret this, which it took us 6 months to write this, and for her to adequately explain them, that's a burden that no one should have to do. So I think I should go with them, and then for the GPSA, I'm more than happy. I'll talk to Evan to go with them for that one too, just to explain what's going on. So
that's between you and the, I mean,
we'll
certainly let them know. I mean, they can have, you can attend as any citizenry, and they can invite you. We'll let them know that you would certainly want to do that.
Okay.
But we want full coordination. So again, you're going to wonder about, you're going to have questions about it, et cetera, and we will get to that on the 13th. We obviously will have a handful of other issues perhaps to deal with, but this will be the bulk of the 13th. And then, if you're all happy, we could take a vote that meeting. I suspect, again, it would be the meeting after that before we take a vote for many reasons, but it'll be whatever it is.
I suggest the ombudsman be involved as well. He may know some things that he is not at liberty to say exactly what they are, but they may have to do with the inner workings of 6.4, which seems to me to be pretty Byzantine at this point.
Well, that's true, and let me tell you that if you put it in 6.4, then 6.4 has got to be written, and there's some thought in here that we want some specific representation on that rewrite committee, not just a representative that sees the end product and gets to make a comment before somebody else votes on it.
Mm-hmm.
And again, and there is a precept here that if the code is someday amended to be Title IX compliant, or maybe the interpretation of Title IX changes, that we can put it back in the code, you know, because there is a definite feeling that we didn't want to take it out of the code, but for compliance issues and not to break the existing code, this was the best option we were actually able to come up with. So, at a high level, are there questions, discussion you want to have or after the meeting? I'm sure Phil will stay around. I know I will.
All right, so being none, we'll adjourn the meeting at 6:50.
Thank you for your patience.
Thank you.
This has been a production of Cornell University. On the web at cornell.edu.